today I want to give a little bit of advice. And it is, if decisions are difficult to make, don't make so many decisions. One of the many things I like about living in Florida is that decisions about what to wear are easy to make. Basically, I make one decision for this entire subject. Short sleeve shirts, pants, sandals. Every day, I follow the same decision which I made about 12 years ago. One decision, and it has served me well all this time. You may be thinking, oh, it can't be that simple. You're right. If it is chilly in the house because of our air conditioning, I have a heavy plaid shirt that I can put on. If we're going on or going out, I can take a fleece jacket or a regular jacket. That's it. Easy peasy. Not all of life is so easy, of course, but it doesn't have to be as difficult as we make it. The other day I met a man and a woman. We had lunch, and the wife during the lunch said her husband was very disciplined, and she felt as though she was less so. And to prove her point, she gave me this evidence. He said, he has been meditating daily since 1969. That's impressive. And it means he made a decision to meditate daily, and that is the only decision he had to make. So I wanted to calculate this the other day. I calculated the number of days since January 1st, 1969, till just the other day. That number is 17,685. One decision, or in the worst case, if he started meditating on January 1st, 17,685 decisions. It is easier to make one good decision and make it good than it is to make 17,685 good decisions and to make them good after the fact. I believe this. We make decisions and then we make them be right by the attitude we choose about the decision that we just made. I'm a fan of Walter Russell. He was considered to be a modern-day Leonardo da Vinci in America. He left elementary school at about 9 years old, yet he became world-famous in multiple areas. Paintings, science, music, business, philosophy, sculpture, ice skating, and horsemanship. In a biography about him, and it was titled The Man Who Tapped the Secrets of the Universe, the author Glenn Clark asked Walter Russell why he didn't just implement the many great ideas that he got. And Russell responded essentially saying, why would I do that? That leads to mistakes, wrong decisions, wasted time, wasted money, wasted effort. What I do instead is I go to the source of all knowledge, which is how we refer to divine consciousness or God. He said, I go to the source of all knowledge with an idea, a question, a problem, and when the completed results become clear to me in my awareness, then I take action on the physical level to bring the solution into manifestation. Walter Russell, in my estimation, decided less frequently than the average person. Maybe that is one of the reasons he was so far above average. He decided to take his uncertainty to the divine, and when he became certain, he decided to act on the physical level. There's something to learn there, in my opinion. I bet all of us have this experience where we realized that decision as a concept, as an energy, is a very powerful creative force. Deciding on how we will behave, what our point of view will be, is to take our rightful place as co-creators of our own lives. It just takes decision. I think decision carries this kind of energy. This is how it will be, or better, with an exclamation point, you know, because it is declarative. It is affirmative. It is strongly felt. It is bringing something into existence. And it is not this. I wish, and it is not. It would be nice if, that's not what I'm talking about. That to me is not decision. Oftentimes our most decisive moments come in reaction to the conditions that we've been creating in our own lives. At some low point, we get fed up and we refuse to let that pattern continue. It's at that pivotal point that we decide. If I were talking about Alcoholics Anonymous or any other addiction like that, this is referred to the idea where that person has to hit bottom. And that bottom is where they make that decision that this is unacceptable, it is not going to continue, things are going to be different, and to me, this is where the rebound now occurs. They start ascending to a higher, I'll say, spiritual, mental, emotional, and physical state because of that decision. They got to the point where they were not going to put up with what was happening in their lives. I frequently say that one of the most complicated sports, golf, is the simplest. All golf is distance and direction. You have to decide how far you want to hit the golf ball and in what direction. Simple. However, this is the reality. Actually hitting the golf ball is very complicated. There are many different golf clubs a person has to choose from. 14 in total is what you're allowed to have in your golf bag when you play the game. The angle and the speed of the club face and as it impacts the ball, that is what determines the distance and direction. So that angle and that speed and club face that you're using is really part of the complication of the game. Because if there's a slightest variation in any of that, use the wrong club, wrong speed, wrong angle, that ball is now going to travel in a distance and a direction that you didn't choose for it. Striking the ball at a precise angle with a club face that is traveling, how about this, anywhere from 90 to 100 or even faster miles per hour. That's the distance and the direction you want to achieve is going to follow that. It's like, whoa, wow. Let's move away from the golf course for a couple of minutes. If you get into the water or on top of it, say in some sort of vessel, so it could be any kind of body of water, a lake, a river, a stream, a bay, a creek, a sound, or an ocean, you're going to be affected by natural forces. If you're in a canoe, sailboat, rubber tube, or a larger boat, the winds, the tides, the flow of the river, waves, all of that can carry you in a direction not of your choosing. In the case of golf or boating or, frankly, any form of travel, and in life, we want to decide on distance and direction. Depending on the context, it's a lot easier to understand this. So, if I said, let's talk about formal education, I could ask a person, how far do you want to go in your education? You could say that to a kid, and they would be able to answer that. They would be able to process that question and come up with an answer. Of course, there are standard measurable distances that we're familiar with in regard to education. Right? A person could say, well, I want to graduate from high school. I want to go to college. I want to be a college graduate. I want to go to graduate school. I want to get a master's degree. No. I want to get a PhD or I want to become an MD. Or that's understandable. And that's how we measure formal education. But we all know that formal education is not necessarily the same as mental development. A good question might be, how far and in what direction do you want to grow? You know that tomato plants will usually only grow a few feet off the ground, and then they will only do that if there is a trestle or some sort of wire structure or some sort of fencing that will be providing a lot of support to those plants, because the stems are not going to be able to support the weight of the tomatoes. So that's, people tie the plant to these supporting structures. On the other hand, the consciousness in a particular pine cone enables the giant sequoia to grow hundreds of feet toward the sun and live for more than 1,000 years. Of course, the decisions, in quotes, of what those tomato seeds and what those pine cones can manifest is predetermined by the consciousness within them. It's different with you and me. Humans have an infinite number of directions we can grow into, and an infinite variety of distances that we can grow. All we have to do is make a decision about the distance and direction. If I tell you that golf is played on one golf course at a time, you wouldn't be surprised. But if you're not familiar with the game, this might surprise you, that there are actually 18 separate areas called holes on a golf course. Like, separate area, 18 separate areas with all kinds of differing characteristics, length, shape, size, and so on, complexity. I conceive of human life as taking place in 12 different areas at the same time. I call those areas the 12 worlds. I define them this way: the spiritual world, mental world, emotional world, physical world, family world, career world, financial world, social world, leisure world, community world, political world, and maintenance world. We are playing in one or more of these fields at all times, in my estimation. Sometimes in more than one field at the same time. So an activity that we take in one area, which is clearly involved in it, you know, going out to dinner, you would go, well, this is a physical activity. This is a physical activity because I'm going to feed myself food. So, yep, and who are you going to talk to? And who are you going with? Oh, I'm going to go with my wife or some friend, or I'm going to talk to the waiter, and I'm going to talk to... So it can turn into social. But if it's over a business conversation, then it's like, this is career-related as well. And if we get into mental concepts that are fun to discuss, or spiritual ideas, you go, oh, wow. I really have my toes in a whole bunch of different areas, a whole bunch of different worlds at the same time. And frankly, I think when we process stuff in that way, in a premeditated decision-making, we go, I am really going to enjoy this because this is going to give me rewards in a whole bunch of different areas of my life. This idea of impacting multiple worlds at the same time is not everybody's goal. Some of the most memorable people in history are the most imbalanced. And if we said that a person is more or less balanced when the 12 worlds are more or less in balance, you could say, okay. If we attend to each of these areas of our lives, you can say, I'm not sure I get it. But if I use a different image of the 12 worlds, let's say I make the 12 worlds kind of like a bicycle wheel. So there were 12 sections, 12 spokes. And you go, okay, I'm with you so far. We can recognize pretty readily that if the spokes in the sections of the wheel are the same size, that, oh, you know what's going to happen? My wheel is going to be round. Yep, that's true. If we have a round wheel on our vehicle, be it a car or a bike or a motorcycle, you're like, you know what? Traveling on round wheels is more comfortable. It's easier than, say, a lopsided wheel or wheels that are misshapen or on a flat tire. Two of the most famous, now infamous, athletes in America in recent years have been Lance Armstrong and Tiger Woods. Both were considered to be the greatest athlete in their respective sports, competitive bicycling and professional golf. Both of them were lopsided in their pursuits that, in my opinion, were driven by their egos. They wanted to come in first in the race of life, no matter what, no matter how. Integrity, morality, phew, out the window. Nothing counted except the ego drives for the two of them. Not family, not fairness, not telling the truth, not right behavior. Didn't count. We might say that Lance Armstrong and Tiger Woods, at some point early in their lives, made one decision to be the greatest in their sports. So far, so good. What gets complicated, though, is how the why of that decision plays out. Without a structure, without a framework, being driven by that impulse can be chaotic. If that's the only thing that shows up on their radar, being the greatest, coming in first. Now, some of us would say, wait, become greatest, winning the most race, if that's all they think of as being greatest. In Tiger Woods' case, the winning the most major tournaments, a special category of tournaments, that makes him the greatest. You go, wow, that's a narrow view of greatest. What about being a decent human being? What about being a decent family man? What about being a decent human being? Like, nope, that didn't. Their definition of greatest did not contain those stipulations. Like, oh yeah. Those two guys seem to be driving their, I'll say, vehicles very fast and very hard because they're willing to do things from a practice standpoint that the average person wouldn't do. But they were driving so fast and so hard in pursuit of their goal, it's as if they didn't have any lines on their highway. There were no guidelines on their roads. They didn't stay within the lines of their sport. They didn't stand, you know, they didn't behave the way people commonly expect people to behave, not only in their sports, but in their lives. Like, I don't think you're supposed to do that. Well, if it's against the rules of the sport, or if it's against the rules of common sense, but they didn't get it. They were so ego-driven that rules didn't apply to them. They were above and outside the rules. Seems like their own impulses were God. And anybody who criticized them or judged them was punished or ostracized. Lance Armstrong threatened to destroy the careers of his own teammates if they opposed him. Woods refused to talk to any reporter who wrote anything critical about him. He gave the cold shoulders to other players if they criticized him. And as the two most powerful people in their respective sports, that was a problem for other people. And so everybody is holding back. In decision-making, this is what I suggest. That we focus on what and why, not how and when. What do we want and why do we want it? If we can answer those two bits to that question, we're going to put ourselves in a great position. Then we can make judgments about what it is we're going to do or not going to do, and we can draw the necessary resources to us. If we use our thinking to define what we want, and I think that's a great way to do it, that's what the conscious mind, in my opinion, is for, deciding on distance and direction, just deciding on it. It's not how it occurs, but the decision-making process does occur like that. And if we use the conscious mind and we use feelings to define the why we want something, and wait a minute. We might be able to see how we're going to use energy to bring about that desired condition. When we start considering the why, we hear, ooh-wee, coming first in a race of life, take everything best for myself, hold on to it, cheat, do any lies, steal, do anything to, like, wait a minute. I know what's driving this. That is not the advisor we want to listen to. It's interesting to think of this concept of thinking and feeling. In the Christ letters, letter 5, which I finished again last night, it talks about thinking and feeling. If everything consists of male Father God energy and female Mother God energy, just those two things, and you go, okay, got it. Thinking and feeling. What do you think drives each of those? It seems pretty clear to me that thinking tends to be a Father God male energy process, and feeling tends to be a female Mother God energy process. Feeling. If we want to bring something into physical manifestation, let's say I want to have a baby. You know, as a man, you know what? I better get female energy involved in that process to bring it into physical manifestation. Me thinking of, I'd like to have a baby. If that's all that happens is just thinking without some other energy pattern involved in it, nothing is going to happen. If I want to make a baby, I'm going to cooperate with female energy in order to make that happen. Lots of people that I deal with want to make their bodies healthy. That makes sense. That really makes sense. But they think they're going to think it back into health. And it occurred to me after reading that section of letter 5 last night, wait a minute. Female energy is the body maker. It's the body maker. Not thinking. Female energy, feeling, is the body maker. It worked with making babies, and it makes sense to me that it would work with healing. That's a decision that we need to understand. I want to be healthy. I'm going to think about it. Hold on a second. I want to be healthy. I want to feel it. I want to feel that health into physical manifestation so it actually exists on a physical level. Last night I had a conversation at 9 o'clock with a client. And it's like thinking. I go, you're a woman. And I would say this to a man as well. You're a woman. You need to feel. All this thinking that's going on, this monkey chattering, this stuff, this is part of the problem. Feeling. Now, it's easier to say that to a woman because they can grasp it a little bit more readily than a lot of men, but But I think all people who can't get that, no, if you feel stuff, you can be hurt. If you feel stuff, you can be hurt. And the way to prevent ourselves from being hurt, I made a decision long ago, not to feel stuff. Well, that's certainly true of me as a teenager. I went, wow, feeling hurts. Being sensitive hurts. I'm not doing this anymore. And I stopped feeling stuff for about 7 years. And realized, wow, I didn't feel any hurt. You know what I didn't feel? I didn't feel any life. I didn't feel any joy. I didn't feel any happiness. Maybe this refusal to feel, putting on a suit of armor, was not such a good decision. Maybe deciding that I can process environmental signals and I'll probably survive. I got better than 50-50 chance of surviving if somebody criticizes me or my feelings get hurt. If we can quiet the thinker and pay attention to the feeler, I think we can remake or make a healthy body. That, to me, is a huge concept. The good news when we stop thinking is, or we don't listen to the mind, or we don't listen to the ego-driven mind, is because we only have access to our ego and our thinking, that's not very much energy, frankly. We only have our personal energy and the energy that we can take from other people, steal from other people, or recruit or enroll other people to give us. Oh, could you help me? Oh, could you help me? Right? We play victim. We bully people. We do all kinds of things in order to get access to other people's energies. There's a better way. If our what we want and why we want it is aligned with divine intention, growth, nutrition and nourishment, healing, protection, fulfillment of need, work, survival, and we understand that it's delivered rhythmically and it's governed by the law of cause and effect. We reap what we sow, and that the divine works for us, in us, and through us, then we know what our job is. We go, oh, wow. If we align with the divine energy like that, then we can expect our own energy to be reinforced naturally with these divine consciousness that is working on our behalf for our well-being and the well-being of other creations. It's like, ah, wow. Wow, I got a lot going for me. Yeah. Yeah, we do. Yeah, we do. It's like using the wind with a sail as compared to the only way to get there is to row 1,000 miles. Yeah, I think if you use the wind and you allow the divine forces to support you, you're going to be much better off. When we use ego drives and ego weapons, right? Judgmentalism, criticism, denigration, that whole list that Christ talks about in the letters, we're going to be sowing the seeds of rejection and resistance. It's going to show up because we're going to reap what we sow, but we're also going to see it not only in us growing in our own garden, our own consciousness, but we're going to see it in the behaviors of other people. They're going to oppose us because their egos, right? They're not interested in being used or criticized or emotionally or physically attacked or pushed aside because we're interested in coming in first to the race of life and we disregard and disrespect them. They're going to like, no, 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 no. There's going to be a lot of resistance to us from their point of view. We're going to expect them to oppose us and they're going to expect to oppose us simply because that's what we have sown. That is not the kind of decisions we want to make. If we can become more effective at making a decision of what we want and why we want it, to me, it's almost as if we have, let's go back to a boat metaphor. It's almost as if we have streamlined the bow of the boat. Instead of a square bow like a barge or something, a scow that is only going to be able to go through the water very slowly because it creates so much resistance in the water, we would instead become like the bow of a clipper ship, like a sailboat that is so fine, it zooms through the water because it doesn't create resistance. We have that ability. I had a conversation the other day with a friend who thought he, and verbalized, that he felt he wasn't disciplined. But as he was talking, I said, I don't think you're right there. I think you're phrasing that and framing it incorrectly. It's not that you're procrastinating, it's that you haven't decided. If we're afraid of decisions, guess what? We're not going to approach them. We're going to fight them or we're going to avoid them. Fight or flight. It's real. You go, oh, wow. My wife, Marianne, was a partner in a consulting firm for years after she retired from IBM. And she's taught in, I think, 105 different countries. And one of the things that she used to teach these global sales teams that were trying to be like the top 2% of all salespeople. So her clients would take the top 20% of their sales force and have Marianne and her partners train them to become more like the top 2%. She used to deal with a personality profiling system. So number one, the people would recognize how they personally like to receive and process and deliver information. And secondarily, how clients are apt to be able to process and receive and deliver information. If you know how people want to exchange information energy, and ditto for yourself, communication and relationships are a lot easier to establish and to maintain. So in this, it used to be called the Carlson Profile, or DISC. It's like, yeah. So decisions have different significance to each one of these these personality types. Now, we have all four of them, typically. Just a couple of them tend to be more pronounced in us. The D stands for dominant. This is a person who thinks they have enough information to make a decision, and their decision is right. They tend to be my way or the highway kind of people. Very decisive, not open to a lot of information. The I stands for influential. These are the people who are more social, have great at relationships, like people, deal with people. When they have to make a decision, it is more, how will I be perceived? What will others think of me? So that's how they judge decision making. The S, which stands for steady, those folks tend not to like change. So why do we need to make a decision? Why do we change? Everything seems to be okay right now. Or if they're forced into a situation where they have to make a decision, they want to know how to mitigate it. Well, if we make a decision, can we undo it without damage? Can I get out of this contract without damage? What are the escape clauses? You know, what's the refund period and those kind of things? The C's, labeled conscientious, are people who need a lot of information. It's like, I need more information before I can make a decision because I have to make the perfect decision, as compared to having this understanding that I make a decision, then after the fact, using my own attitude, I make it the right decision, and then if I need to adjust, I'll make another one. C's tend not to do that. I don't have enough information to make a decision. I got to get more research, more input, more this. I got to get another book, another this, another that. Okay, well, now I have to start all over again because I'm sure some of that information has gone out of vogue. It's probably outdated. It's like, and it is this need to be perfect in decision-making that makes it scary. People tend to be dominant in two of these areas. And when you look at that, you go, And we can go back to what we want and why we want it. And we can heal all the early experiences that have terrified us or scared us or hurt us, or we hurt other people by decisions we made or didn't make that produced undesirable results. We can make less decisions, but we can make decisions and we can make them good. I would like to end this service with a prayer. This is the pluralized version of the prayer from Letter 8 in Christ Returns, Reveals Startling Truth. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life, our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. Just think of that. That's a cool sentence, right? If you want anything, you want any kind of thing going on in your life, or you want support, you want something relative to your health or your protection or some fulfillment of your need, or you want to be inspired, like, where would we go? Why not to Father, Mother, Life in our meditations? We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know it is your will that we shall be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know that our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know you are perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal loving intelligence, which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness. And as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. Thank you. It is so. Amen.